From iAfrican Media, this is iAfrican Bites, a podcast that features commentary on African news, insights, opinions, and analysis with tech industry leaders and professionals. The podcasts are from interviews conducted by the iAfrican team, whether at events or when needed for commentary. I'm Badawun Kosokwane, host and editor-in-chief for iAfrican.com, spelled www.iafrican.com. Nando, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Looking forward to, I've actually been looking forward to this conversation because we were at the Google event at the hotel, and that was such a wonderful event. So it's good to finally have a sit down, you know, between me and you. Nando, we're at the last day. Later on this evening, we have the closing ceremony. Walk me through, you know, how was this year's Indaba for you?
It's been amazing.
Yes.
First of all, being back in Africa.
Yes.
I was in Johannesburg for the first Indaba.
Mm-hmm.
2017.
17, yes.
And then I went to the next one.
Yes.
Now I took a gap, as you all know, we had this horrible pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But now coming back, mm-hmm. and especially coming to West Africa,
yes.
which for me is actually a new thing.
Yes.
I've been to spent a lot of time in Southern Africa,
mm-hmm.
and I visited North Africa.
Yes.
But it's wonderful to be here. The people are very friendly. The event itself has been phenomenal, because for me, I can't stop comparing it to the first one.
Okay.
So in the first one, we were just starting. We didn't know. It's like there were such daunting challenges ahead. We didn't know how we were going to expand, if it was going to get any traction. And if I look forward now and I see how the academic world has improved, but also things I could have never predicted. There's so many amazing companies in Africa now.
Yes.
We just heard about InstaDeep opening a new
100%.
Office in Rwanda.
Yeah.
I just went to a brilliant talk by the Lapa people,
mm-hmm.
who are doing amazing work with
100%.
Language. In South Africa, and yes, and they're just like some of those. There's so many startups, Data Science Nigeria. Those people are just amazing what they do. So there's been this explosion of work, and then something else that I find is really amazing about Africa is in Europe, North America, and so on. We're still dealing with some huge sort of legacy problems,
mm-hmm.
Challenges in our community. For example, gender gaps.
Yes.
They're massive for us in the North. And Africa is just leapfrogging that.
100%.
And it's just amazing when you go into a room here,
yes.
and you see that that's not a problem.
Yes.
And perhaps it is. I don't know the exact statistics,
mm-hmm.
but that sort of first impression just makes me feel like in many ways, Africa's ahead and has the potential to be ahead. It has some challenges, but it could go ahead. And, you know, and this has grown so much. There's so many people. It's really beyond any expectations I ever had.
I mean, credence to what you're saying, right? Just on the growth aspect, I think yesterday, Time Magazine published their top 100 AI, you know, influences in the world, right? And about five of them come from deep learning Indaba. So it's just like 360 how from 2017 when you started to now having, you know, four or five, you know, researchers from, you know, the Indaba on that list. It's actually really phenomenal. So I share those sentiments, but I want to go back to your...
And if I can add some words there on that, it's especially touching that some of those people who are now in the... You know, they've gone so far as to be in Time Magazine top 100 people in AI. Some of them were students at that first Indaba.
At that first, yes.
And it's just mind-blowing.
It's
that just
guys.
Kind of, that's one of those things you could not have ever predicted.
Yes.
And it's just like, I'm just so proud.
Let's go back to your early days when you're a student, right? So you're doing your undergrad and your master's at Wits University. What were some of the courses or professors that really shaped your destiny, your ambition to really pursue AI, machine learning world?
Yeah, I think WITS was and continues being an amazing university. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, it's one of the best universities in the world. And there's so many good people there. Some are still there, like Professor Jandrell and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, some, you know, have, you know, I guess me showing my age, some have passed away. I remember Professor McLeod fondly. He introduced me to neural networks.
Neural networks.
What I coded backpropagation for the first time almost 30 years ago, 1994. And then I also learned a lot from Professor Ridley, who is my math professor, Professor Driver. Arthur Stevens, Clark for electromagnetics, Perrine. They really had an amazing faculty, and we learned so much there. And it prepared me really well for Cambridge, for Berkeley, and for all the places I went to subsequently.
Yes. Would you say I'm just trying to benchmark as far back then, 94, when you started, and you went on further to Cambridge and, you know, the wonderful work you've done overseas, how advanced or how backward are we when we benchmark ourselves? Your experience would be WITS. Are we further? Are we on the same par, or is there some certain, you know, specific things that happen in the Western Hemisphere that, you know, make them more, you know, ahead
That's a very good question. I think first of all, I think we all feel like we're behind. Mm-hmm. If you're in Africa, you always feel like you're behind.
Yes.
And you feel like you're behind in many ways. Mm. Not just that you're behind in the sense of access to, say, compute, which matters a lot to AI, but also you feel behind in terms of your tech, in terms of your universities. Mm-hmm. And you also feel like you, and I certainly felt mm-hmm. that way, that that imposter syndrome, that you're
of
not
course.
As good as someone as, who as, goes as to people, Cambridge or so. And one of the nice things about WITS University is when I was doing my undergrad, and this was actually Professor McLeod invited a professor from Imperial College, I still remember his name, Lambeer, even though it was like 30 years ago. And he gave a presentation in control systems, and then I started talking to him at the end. Mm. And like something amazing happened. I saw that I could have a conversation with a professor from Imperial. And the fact that I was even surprised kind of tells you about the sort of inferiority complex that I felt like I couldn't have a chat with this guy. And then that just made me believe, you know, and then with support of, you know, friends and family and so on, I eventually sort of applied to Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And that was the first big jump. It's not even getting accepted. It's just believing that you can apply and you can go there. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the reason why I always come to the Indaba. Sometimes, you know, I give some presentations and so on, but it's just people realize that, you know, you may be a Google research director and so on, or an Oxford professor as I was, but you're not different in terms of what you do or intellectual capacity or anything like that. I think everyone has a chance. But of course, in other ways, the gap is there in terms of access to resources, to compute. We have unique geopolitical situation in Africa with many challenges, including energy, South Africa, climate, food, being able to just provide food for everyone, farming and so on. And, you know, these are sort of problems we don't encounter in the United States or England or France. So there are differences, but hopefully, you know, through education, through more efforts like this, through the people that are coming out of these efforts, we'll be able to address those challenges and move forward.
I like what you say when you say it's important for, and I love the fact that you realize that, like, for you to come here to desensitize, you know, aspiring research and scholars to say that, no, if I can work at Google DeepMind, you can. And in, when they have a conversations with you, they see themselves and you're like, oh, so you're also introverts. Oh, so it can be done and work at Google DeepMind, you know? So it, I think it's very important. And I love the fact that you realize that and you make it a point to come every year. Now, Nando, you do a lot of work with Google DeepMind. Can you share some insights into the current research priorities at Google DeepMind that you're involved in right now?
Briefly, so, I mean, I had a presentation on generative AI. I think that's really important. This is like generating language or generating images or generating, as I mentioned, even the 3D structure of proteins and so on. So these are all, I think, very important problems. Language, language models have the potential to have vast impact on things like education. You know, a lot of people have access to a phone, and if you can outreach people, engage in dialogue, it could even help with just informing people and eventually sort of just so that, because that's the first step, just like I had to believe to go to Cambridge. A lot of people just need to believe to figure out that there's a better way of farming or just need to believe that there's a way of growing a family.
Especially for the traditional people in those sectors, because you'd have a farmer that's been doing this for 30 years like you, that's been farming, you know, the past 30 years, however they've been farming. And then now you come and tell them about this new AI stuff. They're like, but I've been doing this for 30 years.
Yeah, because we all get trapped in our ways.
Yes.
And we just sort of continue doing what we did forever.
Yes.
And so you may say, do subsistence farming. Mm-hmm. And I just met this amazing guy, Fred, I forgot his surname, who works actually in trying to improve farming practices in Ghana, and actually is now throughout Africa. And step one is education. But for that to work well, you also have to, one, you have to speak in the local languages of those farmers. So we need AI tools that really work well on those sort of rare languages and so on. We may want, you know, AI tools that work directly with the spoken languages as opposed to try to transcribe them first into writing. So there's a lot of unique challenges. Actually, I'm leaving this conference having learned a lot, and I'm kind of looking forward to actually doing some research in some of these problems. So I think we, you know, at Google, we certainly gain from understanding the problems. Because that gives us our new challenges and focus. Yeah, those are some of the things that I'm interested in doing at DeepMind. Okay. And I'm glad to be part of this community and just to try to think of how could our research actually help.
Walk me through a day at the office, because I'm trying to paint, you know, a picture of how, what it feels like to work at Google DeepMind. Like, what happens? What's the culture? As, you know, coming from, you know, Zimbabwe, South Africa, and being in that space, how does it feel like? What's the culture?
Yeah, so I think depending on what you do, maybe your day is different.
Okay.
I'm now a senior researcher, I have I manage a lot of people and I'm involved in several projects. I like to keep my mornings free.
Okay.
So that's like one piece of advice I would give to any entrepreneur. And so always block some time where you can just focus and do your thing. And during that time, I like reading papers. When I read papers, that's my time to sort of think and write. It's also, the morning's also a good time where I can look at code and sort of catch up with projects and so on. I try not to do emails because otherwise you go, that's like a rabbit hole. You go down that rabbit hole, you're trapped. So I try to do that at the end of the day after meetings and so on. And often try to do that at home because it's like I can just grab a cup of coffee and you know, get my paper then and read it. And then I go to work, maybe have a couple meetings. I actually like sitting. We now only work I have to go to the office 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. I like to go all the time for some, you know, I actually am very social, yeah, so I actually like the people.
You like actually seeing people. It's, you know, yeah, you like me. I'm exactly like that. Like,
some people just want to be by themselves.
I can't work from home. Like, I can, but I need to see other people. I need in the sense of, okay, we're at the office, there's coffee, I have a chit-chat, and I come back. Like,
yeah.
I also need that a lot. Yeah.
The Google offices are very comfortable. So, yeah, we do have the coffee, we have the biscuits. Too many biscuits, actually, for...
Yes, yes.
You have to watch out for your weight when you join Google. It's just too easy. They have the opposite of the food security problem. But and seriously, you know, then I like to have lunch with my team.
Okay.
It just seems like you're just going for lunch and so on. Mm. But actually, that bonding experience, mm-hmm. and we may just talk about random stuff, what's going on in the news, or I don't know, the latest in Eurovision. You know, we'll talk about football, anything you want to talk about, the latest scandal,
yes.
and so on. Gossip. But I think that bonding is really important because people are more than just their work.
Yes.
And somehow that kind of puts us in a better space to then go and have our meetings, to do our brainstorming stations in the afternoon, to, you know, where we do sort of planning meetings, designs. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things is when you can go to a whiteboard and brainstorm.
And just brainstorm,
And that's just wonderful.
Yes.
And that's pretty much it. So the afternoon goes, maybe a couple trips to have more coffee. So trying to cut on that tea in the afternoon these days. Yes. And, you know, and then I think it's towards the end of the day that I look at email and so on. But of course, research engineers who are more on the software development would have a different day. They might just go straight to coding and from my perspective, it's about trying to protect that time so that they can do their work.
Uh-huh.
And but it's definitely fun. It's very collaborative. Google is definitely not a place where you should go in expecting you're going to be working alone. Actually, the human skills are as important, if not more important, than actually your coding skills. It's you don't code alone. It's a community. And so it's good to learn to communicate well with others, learn to put your ego aside, and to think about the greater good.
Yes. In your earlier days of research, you did a lot of work on Bayesian methods for neural networks. How has those methods changed over the years?
Things have changed a lot. So, I mean, there were many things we investigated that proved not to be the right hypothesis or the right thing to do. And in many ways, the stuff that I do now, the things we're doing with training neural networks and so on, it's the closest to it in my career is what I was doing, actually, funny enough, in South Africa in the 90s. It's like going, you know, especially because, you know, at some point, one thing we did at WITS is learn about assembly language and so on. So you needed to understand the hardware well. You needed to do low-level code. And it was mostly about neural networks and backpropagation and so on. And what we do now in the training of language models and so on is kind of similar. It's no longer like this sort of lone wolf single person doing that. Now it's a large community doing it. I studied many things, and every time I did that, I learned something new. And I'm glad I went through all those things because they all gave me different perspectives. Like the Bayesian gives me a very strong probabilistic interpretation of everything we do. And that's a good way of thinking that helps me with my research even now. And many things I tried, many hypotheses failed. And that's the nature of research. Most of the things you'll ever try as a researcher will fail.
Yes. And so basically, you shouldn't be scared of failure.
No, failure is the, well, one is the opportunity to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that that's the nature of science. You know, science is not about proving that you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Science is maybe is always questioning.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a sense, it's more about proving that you're wrong than that you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, especially for young scientists, is very important to know. Of course, you hope that you're gonna do a few things right.
Yes, yes.
And so you have to just keep trying.
Yes.
And keep believing. And, you know, and sort of go also with that instinct of thinking, okay, actually taking the time to think and not just going with what everyone is doing,
mm-hmm.
but also trying to think, okay, what are the interesting problems?
Mm.
And try to distill it to the simplest possible thing. You know, just because, you know, if you try to complicate things too much,
yes.
then you're probably lost.
You get lost.
You really need to simplify things, and you should try to solve the simplest possible problem with the simple, you know, the one that can be achieved and with the simplest possible approach first, always.
Mm-hmm. Now, you work in multi-instance learning, won you an award, right? The Dr. Seth Award. And I found it very fascinating. I just need to know, like, all these, you know, whether it's Bayesian and multi-instance, what real-life applications have you, this research you've done manifested in through, you know, projects or applications in the real world?
Yeah, so all of them have had applications.
Okay.
And so,
I mean, if you could give us examples.
So the Bayesian models, for example, back in the day, there was a sort of naive Bayes classifiers and so on. These were your spam filters. So initially, when we started with email, everyone had too much spam, and spam was so bad that it was going to bring down email, and also terrible for people because, you know, there's some people who are not tech savvy. Using email, they can very quickly be, you know, convinced by criminal to sort of give them their bank account and, you know, do all sorts of terrible things. So building spam filters was really important. Being able to make, and this is the current challenge, that challenge we continue facing even with language models and so on, it's about making the technology safe for the users, for everyone. And so that plays a role directly there.
Ooh,
I mean, that's a huge industry for definitely. Like Gmail and so
definitely.
On. Multi-instance learning is about being able to, if you have a statistics about groups, it's about trying to find, just from group statistics, try to find information about individuals. So it's like decoding to the individual level. And this happens a lot in products on the web.
Okay.
So you might have information at a very broad scale, maybe through reviews, say, in Amazon, about a restaurant.
Mm.
But multi-instance learning then allows you to go deeper.
Much more deeper.
And be able to say, even though you don't have ratings about the quality of the parking at this restaurant, through those techniques, it will be able to highlight that information. And so all of a sudden, it's sort of you can enrich your data with metadata that allows you to, you know, much more easily make recommendations to users.
Mm-hmm.
So a few companies, I won't mention their names, yes. were using some of our results for that.
It's amazing. Like, we take spam for granted. The fact that it filters itself out. Because you have all these messages coming in, right?
Yeah, now we use new technology. Yeah, you know, by now, I think the naive base has been superseded and so on by fancier techniques. But, you know, the technology is always evolving.
Yes.
Nothing is stationary.
Yes.
You can't just expect that your research today is going to be forever. No, it's going to be different in a few years. It's always evolving. And the problems are evolving. And you just need to accept change.
On that aspect of change, what trends and technologies that are happening in AI and machine learning that gets you excited right now? What's happening that's like, okay, I'm interested in that. That looks nice.
I think it's for everyone. We've heard so many times here in this conference, people talking about ChatGPT.
Yes.
Google's also in that world, yes, BART and so on. And that is very exciting.
And it's
exciting because it's a very powerful technology. Language can, language is the most powerful tool that humans have. This is how we plan how to do things. This is how we interact. This is how we communicate. And we didn't always have this. Uh-huh. We created this. Uh-huh. The written language is about, 10,000 years only. Uh-huh. It's, this is not something we've always had as a species. But it's a tool that there's a philosopher, Daniel Dennett, that says once you learn to manipulate a tool, create a tool, the tool also changes you, thinking. And language, we think about our thoughts in language and so on. So that's incredibly important. It will affect everything profoundly. And of course, these models are also becoming multimodal. So it's not just language, but it's images and so on. And once you have a model that's multilingual, I don't know if you've seen the movie Her. It's about this guy that has a cell phone that he puts here with a camera in San Francisco. And then there's an AI assistant that basically...
Throughout the day,
interacts with him, tries to help him.
Okay.
With, it's like life coach as well. Life coach, relationship advice.
I think a lot of people would like the relationship advice.
Yeah, that would be. But that is fascinating because there's, what I imagine, and I think this is possible within 10 years, is to have that kind of coach, for example, for education.
For education.
Where everyone should have access to education in their local language.
Yes.
And with these sort of language models that understand their context and their reality. And I think that will profoundly change the world because that will sort of bring us all together in sharing information and empower people. Because I think the biggest challenge that I find in some African countries or some South American countries when I go to Quito, like Bolivia and so on, is just even not just having access to the resources, not you go to YouTube, and if you don't speak, if you speak an indigenous language, and you go to YouTube, it's all in English.
It doesn't cater for you. 100%.
There's a brilliant resources like Khan Academy and so on, and they're trying to go multilingual, but they got such a long way to go. And then, of course, it's not just about that sort of translating the text, but it's also about you would like to see those people speaking in your language, using the gestures,
the dialect,
that we're used
and the deeper gestures.
Yeah. But I think if we get there, then people will be able to empathize with these assistants, and of course the other thing that comes with it is sort of making such systems safe.
Yes.
Because you also don't want these systems, to influence people in destructive ways or terrible ways. So we need to be, I think one of the biggest challenges now is sort of AI safety, how to deploy AI responsibly. That's by far, I think, the biggest problem we're facing right now. How to make AI count for everyone and how to make it really be useful for everyone.
I mean, you're touching on literally my next question, and ethics is such a big consideration in AI now. How do you navigate ethical implications of your research?
Yeah, so at DeepMind, I'm actually also in an ethics review board. That's part of my job.
That's part of your job.
And so,
hey now.
Yes.
So this is real. It's a real thing for you.
Yes, you have to take this very seriously. We don't just go, for example, now, early in my career, we just got a great idea, we'd go and write a paper. Now I think twice about what will the impact of this be? How will this affect people? If I, or I would think about, let's build this amazing app. Everyone's going to use this. It's going to be great. Now I take time to think about what could be potential unintended consequences of this, because maybe there's a great benefit, but I haven't thought about. And so anything you do, you try to get a wider group of people to consult, to really think about what implications of it could be. It should, you know, all technology should be much more carefully reviewed these days than what we used to do.
Is there a metrics or a guideline to establish those as you're going about investigating and ascertaining those implications? Is there a guideline or certain metrics that you look at that, okay, this, take that, you need to consider this? Is there some sort of that?
There are some, and I guess there are some values that we adhere to. But I think we're also in a process of actually learning. Mm-hmm. You may want to do good, and the thing that does good can actually be, can have unintended negative consequences as well. And so, emails are a wonderful thing. we can all agree that allows us to communicate. Yes. But it can also be terrible for spreading propaganda.
Yes.
Or
scamming people, phishing attacks, and.
YouTube is wonderful. Like, if I want to listen to talks, I go to YouTube, I listen to some really interesting talks, I get distracted, watch the football highlights, and then go back and so on. But it's also, it has that problem that you also could, if we provide media in a way that keeps people entertained, it also can become addictive.
100% fake news.
Or you can go, down the rabbit holes and so on, fake news and so on. These are all important challenges. And I think our community is thinking a lot more about these. I think the community has also realized that these are not just AI problems. Mm-hmm. They really are multidisciplinary problems. So the problems of governance, the problems of law, and even business. How do you create the right incentives for people to do the right thing? Mm-hmm. That's a big challenge. And in terms of safety with the actual AI technology, I think it's fair to say that we have some good ideas. There's some works that I love, like Stuart Russell's Compatible AI book. There's been many papers on how to address safety and so on as well. And there's a lot of great work that is talking about the questions of bias and how to make sure that there's a diverse group of people working on AI, because otherwise we will create technology that will not be universally helpful. And could be, in fact, harmful. So there's wonderful work, but I don't think we have the answers yet. Mm-hmm. And I think scientists need to also be thinking about these problems of alignment and so on. And it's fascinating research. There's wonderful people are working on this, and at OpenAI, Ilya Sutskever. There's many people at Google working on this. In academia, we saw Jeff Hinton, an old colleague of mine, is now very preoccupied about this, folks at Miller as well, and even folks who seem to take a different view, like they're more sort of publishing and so on, Jan LeCun, they really are interested in solutions, but we just don't know the solutions yet. And so just like we try to solve the technological problems, we also have to kind of figure out how to make AI safe. The challenge is open, and we should all be working on it and thinking about it.
Now, from a business perspective, I mean, I know, Google has bought, OpenAI has ChatGPT, but so essentially a competitor. But I'm trying to find out, from a research point of view, and creating that safety and creating sort of sharing insights and data, does your research, do you work with other, like OpenAI's researchers? Do you meet and talk about these things and share ideas from a research perspective, that is?
Yeah. So actually, even though we can be, say, different organizations and so on, we do try to create a sort of meta organizations like partnerships and AI that sort of bring us together.
Yeah.
And so that's helpful. But this is often not said, but I think also something that really matters is a lot of the people that are at OpenAI, I mean, I'm at Google DeepMind, but mm-hmm. folks that are, I have many friends at OpenAI. Okay. I have many friends in Apple and Amazon mm-hmm. And so on. And you know, NVIDIA. And we chat. We have meetings like this one like where this. We get together. You know, I was having breakfast with someone from Microsoft Research. And that gives us a chance to sync. And I think we're all kind of, we're in this, we all care about the technology being safe and useful. And I think many of the companies are here. So that's good. I think we have that, I guess, it's kind of like friendship safety net.
Now, I'm going to ask you this question, Nando. In these conversations, because, I mean, you're one of the few Africans in the space, right? At these companies, these big, big corporations, technology corporations. What is the perception about Africa and sort of our research in AI? And what's the level of seriousness that they take? And the reason why I'm asking you this, you know, was because Sam Altman was going around the world when they, you know, launched their product. You know, he went to Europe to go explain what's happening. He went to Asia. But he didn't really come to Africa, you know. And it got me thinking, is this a situation where it's not financially viable, meaning that maybe the bulk of their subscribers or revenue comes from those side of the world, or they just don't take Africa serious, like, we don't need to go there. They'll hear it through news outlets and stuff. So, yeah, if you could just paint that picture, like, what is the perception of Africa in those meetups when industry, tech industry, has these conversations?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, I don't know what everyone's perception is, but I do think that perhaps Africa is not seen as a serious player because we haven't had, you know, the research, the international research publications. It's only over the last 5 years that Africans have begun attending these international conferences and publishing. And it's really expensive. There were reasons for why that didn't happen before and why it's still very challenging now compared, you know, most of these conferences are in Europe. This year, for the first time, a international conference in AI came to Africa. That was the first time in history. And that was ICLEAR now in Rwanda. I think for all this, you also need champions. So I've been, I was heavily involved in finding funding for the first and the second Indaba. And often what I relied on was contacting friends at Amazon, I remember, I would find who is who in what organization, and I would reach out to try to get some money from them. So I tried to help that way. And you really need a champion. So we have good champions at Google, DeepMind. I mean, there's folks like Shakir and the whole gang, Aviskar, Ulrich, and Jeff Dean's always been a champion of these events from the Google side. You know, we have champions now at Apple, like Sami Bhenger.
Yeah.
And I think you need them.
You need those people.
For these companies to want to be part of this.
Yeah.
And hopefully we will be growing that network. Hopefully we'll get those champions.
I mean, we're already growing it.
It is growing, and hopefully we'll get the folks,
even more and more and more. Yes,
African folks and OpenAI convincing Sam next time to come to the Indaba.
Yes,
and so I would say, I would love to see my old friends here, Ilya Sutskever, come to the Indaba.
Yes.
It would be amazing to have him here.
Yes.
It would be amazing to also have folks from Amazon. Amazon plays a big role in Africa. Much of the cloud was designed here in Stellenbosch. And so this is the beginning of some really big things that have happened in computer science. Yeah, and hopefully people, you know, it's also a question of awareness. Sometimes people just don't know. Like I had once a researcher from Amazon Cloud coming to give a talk. And then the researcher, through that trip, actually learned all about the origins of the cloud and the important
role that
Stellenbosch played in the
yeah.
creation of the Amazon cloud. And then when people attended VITS, and you know, there were some people doing talks on Gaussian processes, mm-hmm. which is a machine learning technique that's very popular, and then realized that the technique is also known as kriging.
Okay.
And it's called kriging because there was a professor who invented it to do gold exploration at VITS.
Wow.
And his name was Krieger.
Kriging, okay.
And now that technique is used worldwide, but no one
even I
knows
don't know
that it comes from it comes from
VITS. Even I don't know that.
And
That's
so
amazing.
Many amazing people have come out of that place. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk, you know, like the folks who work on perceptrons
mm-hmm.
Came from VITS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many. Africa has actually been quite influential from the beginning in machine learning and AI. We just, maybe there's not enough awareness about it.
Nando for Google DeepMind, thank you so much for coming. I think, Nando, your experience, I can hear it as I'm speaking with you, and I think you've got a mountain of wisdom, and I think your presence here is highly appreciated. I think aspiring AI scholars, researchers, enthusiasts, needs you to come here. And we're looking forward to having you next year. We'll definitely be back next year.
I'm looking
and
forward to
I'll
it.
I'll definitely keep having conversations with you prior and before next year's event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to iAfrican Bytes. Please share your feedback with us on our socials. On Twitter at iAfrican. On LinkedIn at iAfrican.com. And check out our other podcasts, The Tefo Mohapi Show, Take Legal Matters, and The Lead Creator, on all podcast streaming platforms. And also make sure to head over to www.iAfrican.com. That is iAfrican.com/radio. And subscribe for notifications. iAfrican Bytes is an iAfrican Media original show produced by Nzalo Mbangana and content producer and host by Don Kotokwane.